time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for September 21st, 2019. This week, I chat with three really interesting people, two expansive thinkers in totally different fields. One is urbanism. The other is what he terms economic sociology. And I also bring back Dan DeVise, whose book, The Comeback, Greg LeMond, the True King of American Cycling and a Legendary Tour de France, which we reviewed, by the way, when it came out in June of 2018, inspired Congressman Mike Thompson of California to introduce House Bill number 3589 to award Greg LeMond the Congressional Gold Medal, the second highest civilian award in the country. How cool is that? I don't think Greg LeMond was ever totally forgotten, but I do think he never really received the accolades and recognition he deserved as a true champion of our sport and of his conduct in the peloton. Dan DeVise tells us the synchronistic way this honor came about and what happens next. Then we speak with James Madison University sociology professor Ben Brewer. Ben grew up in Northern California during the big boom era of mountain biking and innovative frame building. He studies and reports on social issues and how they are juxtaposed against economics. And his new case study is bicycle frame builders. He's developed a survey for frame builders, and it's about to close. And in addition to sharing that link with frame builders, I wanted to know what he wants to know. Lastly, but definitely not leastly, Gabe Klein has been on my radar for a long time. I first learned about him when he was the transportation commissioner for Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago. Gabe's thoughts and ideas about cities, transportation, and the broader ramifications of getting it wrong make for a very interesting conversation. So it's off to Virginia to speak with author and journalist Dan DeVise. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this morning with such fabulous news.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very grateful.
Well, when we last spoke, we were talking about your new book, The Comeback, Greg LeMond, the True King of American Cycling and a Legendary Tour de France. And now you have an announcement that might just give Greg his due. Tell us about it.
Well, one of the first people who read it, or at least who like emailed me saying they'd read it, and this is last fall, was this congressman, Mike Thompson from Napa, Sonoma. And it made sense because I was out there on my book talk. I did a lot of book talks around Northern Cal because that was the district where Greg raced as an amateur. And there's tons of bike freaks out there. So lots of avid cyclists. So anyway, the congressman contacted me. And first he was talking about meaning Congress, could put Greg in charge of some kind of new medal or new honor or something involving, heroics and derring do and athletics. And he talked about it. We talked. And then some months passed. And then in summer, it was May or June, his office, his aide contacted me and said, the congressman is going to try to give Greg the gold medal. And I had to Google it. But it's one of our two highest civilian honors, along with the Medal of Freedom. And I sure know the Medal of Freedom because Andy Griffith, who I wrote about in a previous book, got that. It's for like transcendent sort of accomplishment that goes way beyond whatever field you're in, basically. And so then ever since then, I've just been kind of following it as a member of the sort of audience, waiting to see what would happen. And he did it. He got 2/3 of the Congress behind it. And so it's passed this huge hurdle just yesterday, Thursday, the 19th. It passed out of the House, and now it goes to the Senate.
So this is just amazing. What is Greg saying? Have you spoken with him or have you heard from him?
I've not actually spoken to him on the phone, but we've been in touch with each other over the last several days. You know, he's humbled, he's honored. I think he knows in the back of his mind that he is at this level of accomplishment, that he is one of our great all-time great athletes. On some level, he knows that, but I think he's a humble dude, and I think that I don't think he would have dreamed. I mean, you can ask him. I don't think he would have dreamed he was going to get recognized in this kind of way outside of his sport, outside of the cycling world. And that's what's so cool about this.
It is cool. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan DeVise. He wrote this wonderful book about Greg LeMond, The Comeback. And now Greg LeMond is going to be, we think, receiving the Congressional Gold Medal? Is that what it's called?
The Congressional Gold Medal. It's kind of it's a companion honor to the President's Medal of Freedom. And I know more about the Medal of Freedom because those get dispensed to like four or five really big people at a time. I think the Congressional Medal is more of a one-off. Just to give context, right before they did Greg's legislation, they were considering a Congressional Gold Medal for the women behind the Hidden Figures story. The NASA African American women who basically were incredibly important to NASA in the early years. So yeah, it's a big deal. Mother Teresa got one.
Okay, that's good company to keep, don't you think? So what is the next step? Now that it's passed Congress, it's been sent over to the Senate. It's a bill actually that was introduced.
Oh, it proceeds just like any bill. It has to go to the Senate and then it goes to the President's desk. Because it's such a high honor, it requires two-thirds majority of approval, not just a simple majority. I think that's called a supermajority. Now, Congressman Thompson assembled that majority with great ease in the House. His aide told me it might be a year or two, and here it is just a few months. I think people leapt at the chance to honor Greg. I think that as soon as they understood and kind of remembered who he is, because there's always that that pause whenever you talk to somebody about Greg LeMond, it's like, wait, oh yeah, I remember him. You know, the median age in the House, I think, is 58 or something. So most of these people are old enough to remember him, and they leapt at the chance, I think. And so in the Senate, he's got to get I'm bad on math, 66, 67
something
people.
Like that, two-thirds of 100.
Like that.
Two-thirds of 100.
And, you know, I'm told that he's bullish on his chances, but, you know, politics could intervene. I hope they won't, because I don't think this is a political story.
No, I agree with you. This is definitely a bipartisan story. So we're following, I take it you're following the bill. When do you think it'll come up in front of the Senate, or do you have any idea?
I don't have a clue. You know, it's 8 in the morning here. I haven't spoken to the congressman's staff or to the congressman himself. That's obviously the next step. If I had to guess, this took from when I first heard about it to now, you know, a handful of months. I would have to guess that I guess that it's fewer people in the Senate, so maybe it's fewer conversations. If I had to guess, it would maybe be a matter of some more months. And then it would go to the President's desk, and that's a real interesting question. President Trump, you know, we know he's a fan of cycling, right? Because there was the Tour de Trump, which was right toward the end of the Greg LeMond era.
That is true.
So I think I saw a picture of him, like, shaking hands with Greg. I mean, I think he knows him, and I can't imagine he wouldn't like him if he knows him, because everyone who knows Greg pretty much likes him. So, you know, I got to feel sanguine about it.
Yeah, I hope you're right. You know, as we say, from your mouth to the goddess's ears. So why do you think this might be important to our sport? This is an opinion, sort of an op-ed right here. You know, the sport has had its up and downs over the last few years, and now we're bringing back who I think is probably truly an American hero, who was sort of brushed aside for a while. Do you think this, let me rephrase the question, and do you think it is important to our sport and it will sort of elevate it at all in the eyes of the American people?
Yeah, I think that the story of Greg LeMond, the story I attempted to tell in the comeback book, is one of the great stories in all of sports, which is to say in all of sort of human competition. You know, there are not many athletic stories I could think of that are as stirring as his story. So notice I'm not saying cycling, I'm not talking about cycling. I'm talking about the human endeavor and sort of great American stories. And so I think I keep saying this. I wrote a piece in Bicycling magazine about this. I think it's bigger than cycling, but I think it's great for cycling because, yeah, cycling's been knocked around. It's been like ridiculed and derided in ways that other sports that have had similar problems have not. Baseball, football, Olympic sports. There are, I can't think of one that's as derided over sort of a performance enhancement issue as is cycling. So yeah, to have to rediscover and to sort of honor a wonderful, stirring, great American comeback story in cycling that's also from this wonderful kind of innocent breaking away era is just splendid. And yeah, it can only elevate the currency of cycling. Now, I don't think that's like recreational cycling needs elevation. I think it's huge. I mean, there's millions and millions and millions of people out there riding bicycles. But let's talk about bicycle racing. That endeavor could use some elevation, and I think it deserves it, and I think Greg and Greg's story could give it to the sport.
Well, we will keep watching. We will make sure that the moment it passes the Senate, we say something about it. We did. Once you contacted me, you know, we already have people watching. And perhaps if people are interested, they could contact their senators and say, this is an important thing. Please pass this bill. And I don't know. Do you know the bill number?
Oh, wait, let's see if it's on my computer screen. Well, no, but if anybody out there who Googles Greg LeMond bill or Greg LeMond Congress,
yeah,
you'll find it because there's a few news reports about it this morning, and there'll be probably some more. And let's say when he gets the bill, I mean the medal, when it's actually pinned around his neck, I think it will be one of these things that's in every paper in the country. And for a cycling thing, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, Dan, thank you so much. We've been talking with Dan DeVise. He wrote the book, The Comeback. If you haven't read it, we reported on it. We had a conversation with Dan when it came out. You can find it on the Outspoken Cyclist blog. And then we are going to watch this and hope that Greg LeMond receives the Congressional Gold Medal. How cool would that be? Dan, thanks for talking with me this morning. I really appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Okay, bye. Dan DeVise joined me from his office in Virginia. If you are interested in getting your 2 cents in to make sure the Senate takes up and passes the bill to give Greg LeMond the Congressional Gold Medal, contact your U.S. Senator today. The U.S. House bill number again was 3589. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, we stay right here in Virginia to speak with Professor Ben Brewer. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back, and before we get Professor Brewer on the line, I've got two quick items to share. We've mentioned the fact that electric cars, self-driving or not, make little or no noise on the road, and it causes concern for vulnerable road users such as pedestrians, disabled, and sight-impaired people. This week, the Green Car Reports is saying that manufacturers will have a choice of up to 5 noises your car can make, from the lightsaber to the V8 rumble and more. They also say that the noises could change with your speed, and that you will probably not be able to totally turn off the noises while you're driving. I think it's good news for pedestrians, sight impaired, and yes, how about us, cyclists? The second item is a fond farewell to one of the more on purpose and prolific reporters in our world as Angie Schmidt leaves Streets Blog after a 9-year editor at the organization. She just signed a book deal with Island Press to put much of that hard-won knowledge and information down so we can all share it. I wish her a lot of luck. We know that for the most part, frame builders are artisans, craftsmen, and women, and engineers. What we don't know is how many frame builders are working in the U.S., either full-time or part-time, how many bikes or frames they might build in any given year, whether they are profitable, and whether they are willing to share some of that information with Professor Ben Brewer in a sociological study he hopes will shed some light on the craft. Hi, Ben. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so you are doing some, and I'm going to call it forensic research. Is that an appropriate term? Maybe?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that gives it a little bit of a sinister cast, but no, it is forensic.
It's about one of my favorite topics, frame builders, right up my alley. So Indeed. Tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, and why this topic came up for you.
Yeah. My title is I'm a professor of sociology at James Madison University in Virginia. I've taught here for 15 years, did my PhD at Johns Hopkins before that. So, you know, that's my professional background. We can talk more about, you know, what motivated the research and all that in a minute. But part of my interest with this project comes from my personal background as well. I've been a cyclist and involved in cycling and interested in cycling since I was a kid. Which is getting to be quite a while ago now. And I grew up in Northern California. I grew up in Sonoma County, California, right next to Marin County, and went to school as an undergrad in Santa Cruz. So just by the accident of birth, I guess, and just being interested in bikes, I happened to have grown up around what was, you know, one of the big waves of U.S. frame building. There was a lot of that going on. I was, you know, first wave mountain bike builders. In Sonoma County, we had Ibis and Salsa, big shops, lots of smaller builders. Of course, there was tons of bicycle building going on across the Bay Area at that time. This is the mid to late 1980s and into the early 1990s. So I'd always had this interest and this awareness of bikes being made by hand. And I just thought it was an interesting niche. And so this project kind of brings together my professional work with that kind of background knowledge that I had and that personal interest.
Your professional work as a sociology professor is, I mean, suddenly we're talking about frame builders to students.
Not so much, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, the specific case that you study, you know, it's not that I'm teaching about bicycle frame builders, but, you know, I would identify myself as an economic sociologist. So it means I'm broadly interested in the kind of social organization of economic activity in society, right, and how that impacts like other social processes and dynamics, you know, things like inequality, how people make a living and that sort of stuff. And so from that perspective, from this kind of more academic perspective, the theoretical perspective, I mean, where this project comes from for me is that I was really interested in looking at people out there in the economy and in society who were using the market and, you know, making goods and buying and selling them, but whose primary goal didn't seem to me, at least at the outset, to be endless growth and expansion. So it was people who were, you know, artisans and fabricators who needed to use the market in order to make a living. They needed to make a profit in order to run a business and make a living doing that. But, you know, they weren't pursuing the same kind of logic as the larger trade in which they were embedded, which is to say the global bike trade, which is, as we know, dominated by these much larger companies whose maybe primary goal above all else is that they have to keep growing and keep expanding. And so I was interested in this kind of other layer of socioeconomic life, which is, you know, people embedded in the market, but whose main goal is not endless growth, but is kind of figuring out a way to make a living doing something that they like and building a product that they're really enthusiastic about. And, you know, frame builders, one could look at lots of different people doing that, right? All sorts of different artisans. I just happened to know about bikes and knew that there'd been this frame building renaissance going on. You know, frame builders just seem really interesting that way. A lot of them are kind of like the anti-scale business, right? Like, right, they're not really seeking to like get bigger and bigger. They want enough, you know, they want to get to a certain size. And so part of what I'm also interested in that is not just the kind of positive side of that, but also what challenges they face, you know, because it's hard to try to figure out like how you balance that need for, you know, a certain amount of profitability and a certain business size, but without trying to scale up, you know, bigger and bigger, so it's kind of the contradictions and the challenges they face is also what I find interesting.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Ben Brewer. He is a sociology professor at James Madison University in Virginia. And we are talking about the lives of frame builders. So just sort of my little, everybody knows this if you're in the bike business, that the way to make $1 million in the bike business is to start with 2 million.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, I understand exactly what that balance needs to be, having spoken with so many frame builders over the years and living with one. So, you know, the difference here is that Brian is not just a frame builder. You know, he has this broader bicycle business that's service and design and a whole bunch of other stuff. So tell me what you're asking frame builders. And what kinds of responses are you getting? And do these need to be full-time frame builders? Or is it just somebody who is building frames partially? It sounds to me like you want somebody who's a full-time frame builder.
Well, no, actually, I'm really glad you asked that part because, you know, jumping ahead to that, what kinds of people do I want to complete the survey? I definitely want people who are not full-time to fill the survey out. And that's part of what I'm trying to get at with this survey is to see how many people really are doing this full time versus those who are doing it part time, people who are, you know, integrating it with other jobs that they have, and so forth. So, you know, to me, the whole full time, part time thing is one of the interesting questions to look at. And so I wouldn't want people to exclude themselves from the survey if they weren't, quote, full time. I think where I would draw the boundary in terms of who I'd want to fill out the survey is more to do with whether they're actually trying to make it a commercial enterprise.
Yes. Okay.
So if you're trying to sell bikes and claiming that you will advertising in any form that you will sell bicycles commercially to somebody, to a client, to a customer, then you could fill out this survey.
How many responses have you received so far?
So I've had about 115, 120. I need to dig back into the response list. I'll probably have to clean up. You know, there's been a number of people who've kind of looked or partially filled it out. But I mean, it's running above 100 now, which is pretty good. But I'd love to get more. I mean, that's why I'm glad you invited me here.
We're gonna give people the way to get to the survey if they are doing this. I have to be honest, I did not take the survey on purpose because I didn't want to skew any results, although you would have figured out it was me. So you can do it both anonymously and confidentially. So what kinds of questions are you asking the people who are filling it out, the respondents?
Yeah. So this is why I like when you said it's a forensic exercise. I mean, I view it as much a census as it is a survey. I think when people hear survey, they often think of an opinion poll or kind of like evaluating preferences. And I view it as much a census. I mean, I'm asking lots of the kinds of questions that you would expect of kind of nuts and bolts, like, you know, how many bikes do you make? Are they frames or completes? You know, what's the typical selling price? And I have a whole thing about different categories of bikes that people are building. You know, just trying to evaluate all the kind of basic demographics of the business, but also frame builders, their own personal demographics and what the structure of their household is. I'm trying to ask some questions that get at other sources of income. Again, getting to this whole full-time, part-time sort of thing, you know, whether people are working for a similar amount of money doing another line of work or whether this is their primary source of income. So it asks a bunch of different questions that evaluate just the structure and organization of their business and their household. You know, also some stuff about what sort of promotional channels they use for the business, whether they go to shows or not. But yeah, you know, all of it is kind of intended to give me a structural, more systematic snapshot of the state of the typical frame builder in the United States, such as there is a typical one.
So do you have any concept of how many frame builders there actually might be I mean, that's kind of one of – I've never seen a compilation saying there are this many frame builders who are working in the U.S., whether it's part-time or full-time.
Yeah. No, that's the big – that's one of the big questions.
Okay.
You know, and I've talked about this with some other folks. I mean, this is – I've been doing interviews on this for a couple of years now. So the survey is kind of coming along partway through this project. I've talked with lots of industry suppliers and other folks, and it's – nobody, you're right. Nobody really knows. I mean, even industry suppliers don't really know because they see all sorts of, you know, they get lots of hobbyists. They get lots of folks that come in, make one or two orders for tubing or supplies and then never make another order. The way I've been thinking about it is that I think there are probably at any given time, you know, at least like 200 people who are either part-time or full-time or want to be active frame builders commercially. So, I mean, this is just a very rough guess.
That sounds like a reasonable number though.
Yeah. And I think, I think that, you know, in the bigger picture, if you really cast the net wide and look at websites, look at Instagram, try to track these folks down, there might be 200 fairly active ones at any given moment, but there's probably like, you know, 400 or 500 people who have their hand in frame building in some fashion at all, like, you know, even hobbyists and other folks
right,
like this.
Right.
But then the other issue is that there's a lot of churn. So
true.
There's lots of new entrants into the field, and then there's lots of people leaving the field.
Yeah, well, I think the North American Handmade Bike Show did a lot to bring custom frame builders to the fore, you know, that suddenly there was this wider interest because of Don Walker's show. But I have a question about what you're going to do with once you close the survey, which it is not closed, and we will tell people how they can get to the link before we're done here. Once you close the survey, what are you going to do with the data that you get?
Right. Well, I'm going to do a few things. I mean, my primary reason for collecting the data is because it'll help me write some more academic papers that, you know, this kind of information will help supplement and clarify a lot of the interview data that I've been using, interviews that I've completed directly with frame builders, but also, you know, drawing on things like all the interviews you've done on the show, you know,
right.
And other podcasts. So the survey data will be really useful to me for my own, you know, academic papers and whatnot. But I'm also intending to produce some kind of a publicly available, you know, free report that would give a lot of the summary statistics from the survey as well, both because I feel like that's my certainly I feel like that's my obligation as a researcher. If I'm going to ask people to give their time to fill this thing out, you know, to me, the frame builder, the people responding to the survey are the ones that ultimately kind of, you know, the data were given by them. And so I'd like to give that back to people. No public report would involve any individualized data. These would all be summary statistics and, you know, averages and whatnot. There'll be some kind of a report that comes out that gives, you know, some sort of market snapshot of U.S. frame building, at least as I can glean it from the survey. But as you know, I mean, There's really nothing else like that out there.
No, there is not.
You know, that's one kind of interesting thing about frame building as a craft trade or whatever we want to call it, is that there's no industry organization, there's no guild. You know, there've been attempts to form those, but there's no centralized repository for any kind of information. There's no organization in the field.
Because you're dealing with that artistic, you know, fiercely independent, entrepreneurial, leave me alone person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And in fact, that's kind of one of the papers I've been trying to draft is looking at efforts that people have made over the years, multiple different efforts people have made to organize frame builders or create some sort of organizations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, they've often run into the kind of paradox of like the very kind of people who are attracted to doing this sort of work are the kind of people that aren't really good at forming organizations,
you know, right?
For better or for worse.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you a question that may or may not be answerable from you. And that is, having talked to suppliers, having talked with frame builders, Do you get any sense that the frame building business, this custom business, impacts the greater bicycle business in the U.S.? And I know that's kind of a weird question, but I'm not sure you don't maybe have an answer.
No, it's a really important and good question. And it's one that I've had in the back, I keep in my mind when I'm doing this project. Because how do you situate what these folks are doing in the larger bike trade? And I think that, you know, from a strictly kind of economic perspective, U.S. frame building is just a blip. I tried a couple times to make some sort of super rough estimate of like the total output, the total dollar value of frame builders. And I wish I'd gone back and looked at those notes before we talked, because I can't give you a great number. But, you know, whatever it was that I came up with, when you compare it to the data on U.S. bike sales or even bike sales in the U.S. through specialty shops. So, you know, excluding things like Target and Walmart and all that. I mean, as a segment of the bike trade, the hand-built trade is minuscule. But I do think that it plays an important role in the bike trade in terms of setting trends, identifying new sort of directions for how people are using bikes and new kind of forms of cycling culture that then give rise to new types of bikes, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good, you know, sort of thinking about it. I agree.
Yeah, no, if you look at the history of NABS, I mean, you can see these waves of styles of bikes that people sort of pioneered at NABS that then over subsequent years get incorporated into what the major brands are doing. And I mean, you know, people from the major brands and all sorts of marketing and industry biz type folks go to NABS every year. And it's, you know, it's, I'm not saying that they're like ripping off what the indie guys are doing, but it's, you know, that's where a lot of these ideas come in. And this whole new form of thinking about sort of adventure cycling, you know, non-road, non-competitive, but intense cycling and the kinds of bikes people need to build for that. You know, to me, that's come straight through the frame building crowd and through NABS and that community, you know.
Tell my listeners how they can participate in the survey if they are a frame builder, where to go to get your survey. And we do want to mention that you will be at the Philly Bike Expo November 2nd and 3rd in Philadelphia. We have not spoken with Bina yet, but I do know that you will be there talking about the survey in one of the seminars.
That's right. Yeah. I'll be giving some preliminary results at one of the seminars. So I'd love for people to show up, you know, frame builders, but also people who are just interested in it. So yeah, if people are coming to Philly, check that out. The survey will definitely be open through the end of this month, through the end of September. So I'd encourage builders that hear this to fill it out in the next week or two. That would be great. It's kind of a good deadline. I feel like things don't get done if they don't have deadlines. So yeah, so go check it out soon. You know, the I'll send you along a survey link as well, but there's a shortened URL that'll get you there is using the bit.ly thing. It's bit.ly/framebuilders. So bit.ly/framebuilders will take you to the Qualtrics survey that's run through my university site. And I'm happy, you know, you could just search for me with my name and James Madison University. I'm sure it'll pull it up, but you can also, I'm happy to have people email me at brewerbd@jmu.edu. So
this has just been fascinating, and I really am interested in the results of the survey, in knowing what these frame builders are thinking and doing. I'm really glad I got a chance to talk with you before you close the survey, because I want to talk with you after it's closed and you have some data. So we have a couple of points at which we can sort of attack it. I have an abiding interest in frame building. I think it's a very important part of our business. So thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it. Dr. Benjamin Brewer, James Madison University. We will talk again, I promise.
For sure.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Professor Ben Brewer joined me from his office at James Madison University. If you are a frame builder who would like to participate in his survey, you can log on to bit.ly/framebuilders and fill it out for him. After a short break for station ID, we'll talk with Gabe Klein. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Jenks, you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. If you go to Wikipedia and type in Gabe Klein, it says he's an entrepreneur, author, investor, and former government official. What I see and what you will hear is a witty, intelligent, and big picture thinker who takes his years of expertise from a bike shop to a yoga commune through government in the transportation sector and combines it all into CityFi, the company that both government and private sector look to for solutions to questions and sustainability and a lot more. Hello, Gabe Klein. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Diane. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. So I have been watching you. Evidently, you've been watching me. We follow each other on Twitter, which is kind of funny. But anyway, you've covered... you've covered a lot of what I term the transportation infrastructure morass that we seem to find ourselves in. You have practical and intelligent ideas, and many have become solutions. So can we begin at the beginning? Tell me about your background and how you decided sustainability and transportation would be your focus.
Yeah. So as a young kid growing up in Connecticut in the 1970s, during the energy crisis, I was lucky enough to have a dad who was extremely sort of infatuated with anything with wheels. So this is a guy who in the late 50s bought a, Porsche 356 and, drove around the country. Sorry about the transportation noise in the background.
That's okay. We don't mind that.
Okay, good. And my dad was really into bicycles. And, back in the 70s, every kid had a bike. You zipped around the neighborhood on your bike and your big wheel and all of that. But for adults to use a bicycle as transportation was not so common. And so my dad opened a bike store in the center of our town in Connecticut. And we lived probably about 8 miles outside of town. He rode to work every day in the bike store. And we had skateboards and we had mopeds and we had bikes and scooters. And so that was my upbringing. And I started riding a little, we used to call them long bikes. It was a little Eastern European bike for kids with 20-inch wheels and it was extremely long and sort of stretched out. And that was my first bike. It was like a 3-speed bike, what I learned to ride on. And I've basically been riding ever since. And, in my teen years, I worked in my dad's bike stores. He continued in that business. In my post-college years, I ran the operations for the largest bike retailer in the U.S. And then I met Robin Chase, and she hired me as a vice president at Zipcar. And I got to really, focus on shared mobility. So the idea of, getting people out of ownership and into sharing, which was a European model that she was bringing to the U.S. And it became actually bigger in the U.S. at the time. And then, had the good fortune after starting a food truck company and working on a business plan for what became Car2Go to then get drafted into government. And when I got drafted into government running the D.C. Department of Transportation, I decided, let's take a radical approach here. I mean, it's not really radical, right? But let's take these alternative approaches to transportation that I'd been using myself and selling for the last, 20 years. And let's see if we can mainstream them. And let's take a really pro-business, pro-safety, pro-health, pro-sustainability approach to selling this to people. So let's not just, try to throw some stuff out there, but let's actually build support and work with all the powers that be, the WABAs in DC, the Active Transportation Alliance, the CEOs of major companies,
and get our mayors excited about it and our civic leaders. And so, you know, it was a really interesting experience. And I sort of get excited every time I think about those two jobs I had running transportation. I typically haven't worked in traditional jobs, but as jobs go, those are the two best jobs that I've ever had.
Wow. Wow. So interesting. Can we back up a second? I just have to ask you a question because your dad owned a bike store at the same time I did. And I'm wondering what the name of the bike shop is. What was the name of the bike shop?
So in Connecticut, it was in Putnam, Connecticut. That first bike store was called Silver Bike Shop. And we were one of the first Trek dealers back in those days. We had RL Skateboards, which is an American-made skateboard. And I used to skateboard all over the town. And then when we moved down south, I actually moved to go to school in a yoga commune in Virginia. And my Hindu name was Gopal that I was given. And so the bike shops down there were called Gopal Bike Shops, which is a play on Gopal. You heard it here first.
I did. And I'm very impressed because I'm also a yoga teacher.
Oh, great. Well, I was doing yoga before it was cool.
Yeah.
In the 70s.
I can believe that.
And 80s.
I can believe that. That is wonderful. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Gabe Klein. We're talking about, well, a lot of things, but we're going to talk about sustainability, transportation, and the work that you're doing now, which is a little bit different. You did work for the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. You worked for the city of D.C. doing transportation. Talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah. So I left government service at the end of 2013. And it's funny, I talk to people and they're like, well, you were in government a long time, you know, 10 years. And I was like, no, actually it was only 5 years. But I was really operating at startup speed. So we were trying to get a tremendous amount of work done really quickly. And, you know, I'm proud of that. But when I left government, I was a fellow, a senior visiting fellow at the Urban Land Institute. And it was really interesting to learn more about the relationship between land use and transportation and get to work with, you know, very wealthy and powerful developers and try to influence them on the transportation front and explain to them why it was good business to do so. Then I actually wrote a book called Startup City on Island Press, and that was a great experience. With David Vega Brockowitz, who was at NACTO, worked with me on it. Kate Chamba worked on graphics. Anyways, a wonderful experience. And then putting that book out on the heels of leaving government and then starting to do some work on the outside as a consultant was fascinating because against the direction of my publisher, I said, I got to do a book tour. And they were like, book tours don't really, you know, result in a lot of book sales. Well, anyway, I love being told not to do something.
Of course.
It's sort of like throughout my career, if I'm told not to do something, then you better watch out because I'm gonna do it. And they told me not to do it. And I think they would laugh at listening to this now because we argued about it. But I said, look, I'll take on sort of most of the responsibility. But we sold a ton of books and we had like standing room only sold out crowds all over the country and even overseas. Speaking about how to make big directional change in cities fast on behalf of people. And so there's a real audience for that. And then started in 2016 with some partners, a firm called CityFi. And we work with philanthropy, we work with cities, and we work with companies and basically take the same approach towards a triple or quadruple bottom line approach to doing good in cities. You know, people, planet, profit, progress. And, you know, throughout my career, I have not really differentiated between government and the private sector. I mean, obviously one is motivated typically by shareholder wealth and one is motivated by the greater good for its citizenry. However, I don't believe that that's how it should be. I really think that the private sector should be much more focused on the greater good. And that the public sector should actually be a little more fiscally responsible and focused on doing what's best for the citizen, but with an eye on the taxpayer dollar. And if you are, for instance, you will build more bike lanes because they are the most cost-effective way to increase throughput and safety in your city. And so we have these knee-jerk reactions to things like fiscal conservatism. Not that I'm a traditional fiscal conservative, but I actually think we can use these arguments. Like, look at how much money we waste on defense. Look at how much money we waste on, hemorrhaging rates on pharmaceuticals. Like, our healthcare costs are double what most countries' healthcare costs are per capita that have, you know, a single payer system or socialized healthcare. So I'm a big believer in looking at what the return on investment is. And I get to speak to very liberal audiences, more conservative audiences. And I think I get people to listen to me because I just try to tell one authentic story. You know, I don't try to tell different people different things. And anyway, I try to have fun doing it.
Okay. I mean, that was a lot. And I think that everything you've said, it's sort of like you're preaching to this choir right here. And I get what you're saying. And I think the people who listen to this show would agree. I mean, I don't want to ask you what you think about what's going on right now, because I know it's going to be a mouthful and we probably don't even have enough time to start that. Except that there has been no infrastructure conversation on a national level right now that I can kind of wrap my mind around. So what do you think is happening? Do we have to go national? Can we go state or local? Or how can we get some things to really happen? And one thing you didn't say was that creating bike lanes also creates jobs. Because I remember that was a good way to put people to work.
Well, yeah, you know, Rahm was very focused on that in Chicago. He really saw this as a key element of his mission to bring more jobs to people at all levels in the city of Chicago and to lure more companies there by providing a high quality of life and showing when people visited that there was a high quality of life, which is obviously a great active transportation system now is absolutely key to that. To your other, you know, larger point, I mean, let's just summarize it by saying that what's going on at the national level is a complete dumpster fire. There's no other way to describe it. It's more accurate, I don't think. And, you know, when I heard that the president was looking at a $1 trillion infrastructure package, I almost had a panic attack, because the worst thing that we could do, the absolute worst thing, would be to invest $1 trillion or any subset of that funding into more road capacity. Not only is it a complete waste of money, fiscally irresponsible, but it would cause, you know, it would wreak safety havoc on our streets. It would take suburban communities that are already suffering from the last 65, 70 years of arterial and highway building and put them in a worse position that they have to dig themselves out of. So the lack of an infrastructure package at the federal level, to be completely honest with you, I've been fine with. I see us more and more as a federation under this administration. I see us as a federation of cities at this point. I mean, we are definitely a tale of two countries. You know, we watch different news sources. We live in different communities, some in cul-de-sacs, some on busy urban streets. I'm not judging, but I'm just saying that we have different views of what is healthy, good for the country. And I obviously sit on one side of that fence. So, I would rather not spend money on things that are going to divide us further. I think that the building of the suburbs and sprawl has actually been a big part of the division in this country. And it's not that I'm a cities only person. I grew up in a very rural area up until I was probably 14 years old. Then I grew up in a college town with a great downtown, by the way, and a pedestrian mall. It's not about the size of the city. It's not about urban versus rural. It's really that the suburbs have been destructive and culturally destructive. And one of the great things about towns or cities, it doesn't matter how big they are, is that when you get diversity, you get a certain level of tolerance and understanding. And I think we're missing that in our country. And actually our transportation system, our land use are big reasons for that. So I am very hopeful for the next generation. You know, my wife right now is actually over at the Capitol. listening to that. What is that 16-year-old girl's name?
She's amazing. She is amazing. She is amazing. We should both know her name.
She just met with Obama yesterday.
Right.
Anyway, I'm extremely excited about Generation Z. I'm excited about rational thought. I'm excited about behavioral economics, and I'm excited about, you know, getting this country back on track. I think what we're dealing with right now is sort of a last gasp of the sort of head in the clouds baby boomer generation. That's not all baby boomers, obviously, but a good chunk of them that just do not want to accept the impacts of their choices.
Well, as they begin to fade from public view, you know, and get into retirement. I mean, I retired, but then I came back and said, I'm not retiring. There's too much work to do. But I think that we're going to see, hopefully, this younger generation stepping up and doing something. So what can, just to wrap up what you're thinking, what do you think are some short-term solutions and maybe one or two long-term solutions to the issues of urban sprawl or suburban sprawl and to the lack of transportation infrastructure other than the automobile?
Yeah. Well, that wonderful young woman is Greta Thunberg.
Greta Thunberg. I started with the T in my brain, and I'm like, and then I couldn't get it. Yep, Greta Thunberg. That's exactly right. She's amazing. Amazing.
She's amazing. She walks the walk. She came over here in a sailboat because she didn't want to burn fossil fuels. And I think if a 16-year-old can do all the things she's doing, why the hell can't the adults, particularly in this country, but in all countries, do more?
Because there are no adults in the room.
Well, that's true. She's much more of an adult on a day-to-day basis than our president, that's for sure, who is a man-child. You know, Cokie Roberts died yesterday,
yes,
as an aside, and he said, like, well, she wasn't very nice to me, but I sort of wish her family well. I mean, it's just, you know, this is the leadership that we have. Anyway, so, you know, what can we do? I mean, I think what's interesting is that economics is a key part of the story. I mean, you saw maybe, let's say, 5 years ago, the suburbs starting to become a little more, you know, ghettoized, if you will, in some places. People were leaving the suburbs and moving back into the city. And so you saw what happened to the cities in the late 60s after white flight start to happen in some counties, even around Washington, D.C., where I live. However, that's changing now because, you know, it's very interesting to look at liberals in cities. Sometimes they go so far to the left that they end up on the right. And, you know, whether it's in San Francisco or even my hometown here of Washington, D.C., you see people that see themselves as progressive. But then they say things like, well, I don't want any more people living in my neighborhood.
Right.
You know, I don't want any more cars coming to my neighborhood, which, by the way, there's not necessarily a correlation there. I don't want more density. I don't want more people on my sidewalk. Well, do you really want sustainability? Do you really want equity? Do you really want tolerance amongst different groups of people? I don't know. I'm not sure. So just because somebody's liberal or conservative, I think until they actually walk the walk and stop being NIMBYs, I don't necessarily believe it. And so, you know, I think that we're facing a real crisis in our cities around housing, and it's pushing people back to the suburbs, particularly young people. Now that millennials are having children, they have been having children, they're moving to the suburbs and they're buying cars. And so, you know, I look at my own hometown where we had, I think, 950,000 people at our height in the 1950s. When I moved here, we were down to 560,000. Now we're up to 730. And you have all these people saying, that's enough. We don't need any more people, you know. And the thing is, we had 200,000 more people. So, and this was when D.C. was at the height of its success. So, you know, I think that we need to understand that more people means more income for our tax coffers, better schools, again, more tolerance, more sustainable living if we do it right and don't build parking. We've got to stop building parking. And every street in our cities needs to be a complete street. Every single street in our city. Now, it's hard. When you build that infrastructure, and this is why I didn't want Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure package, we only rebuild our streets every 30 to 50 years. And so they're going to be in that same basic cross-section and context that we built, right? Now, I wrote an article in Forbes last December, which got quite a bit of play, and I think some people were confused by it. Like, we need bike lanes. And I said, yeah, but you know what? We have all these four-lane, collectors or arterials in our cities, and we need to rethink, like, how can we repurpose those lanes now on our way to having, like, great, separated, wonderful bike lanes and all of that. But what are we going to do in the meantime until that street is actually rebuilt? Let's start just reallocating space.
Right.
And if it's too politically hard to say that we can't take the cars out of all the lanes, because, like, if you're in, let's say Connecticut, right, and you're in a town like where I grew up, and not that many people are biking yet, and you just say, we're going to have dedicated bike lanes, you get pushback, and people say, all winter long, nobody's in those bike lanes. And then they get pulled back and made into car lanes. So if we can have, like, slow lanes, or you can call them mobility lanes, whatever lane you want to call it, and it prioritizes slow travel, it's a little bit thinner, and it starts to get people's head around the idea of reallocating space towards active mobility and slower mobility. I think that's a step in the right direction. And then I think for any new street, any reconstructed street, we really should be building grade separated micromobility and bike infrastructure.
It's so funny because I just had this conversation with Jeff Speck yesterday, and you two could be talking the same talk, because he's talking about taking a four-lane road and making it three lanes. You don't need four lanes and making a dedicated bike infrastructure. It's just so simple, it may be.
Not only that, but the performance of the road, when you do a road diet like that, is typically better. We saw it over and over in Chicago, where you have one shared turn lane in the middle. You shrink from four lanes to two traffic lanes, and you add bike lanes. But the problem is that traditional bike lanes are just violated so much. We really need separation of some sort, or we need some really visual change to the bike lane so that people understand, like, this is narrower, it's slower, there's thermoplastic that says, like, there's a 50-mile-per-hour speed limit lane. And then what starts to happen, we've seen it here in D.C., just naturally occur because there's so many people biking, so many people on scooters and bike sharing, that people then just drift towards that middle lane. They know they can go 25 miles per hour, and they understand that in the curbside lane, the bike's going to take the lane. And that's just the way it goes.
We need to leave it on that. I know you have a place you need to be and things you need to do. Gabe Klein, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Would you tell us how people can follow your work?
Yeah, you can go to GabeKlein.com. You can go to CityFi.co, and you can find me on Twitter, Gabe_Klein. That's Klein.
And there are a lot of things that you've written for Forbes. You have a huge sort of cache of articles that you've written for Forbes. So, yeah, you can find Gabe anywhere. Gabe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Me too, and keep fighting the good fight.
I will. You too.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
If you're interested in Gabe's work, you can log on to GabeKlein.com or go to his company website, CityFi.co. His TEDx talk is a fascinating monologue that wraps up a lot of his basic ideas in 19 minutes. You can find it on YouTube. That's our show for this week. My thanks to Dan DeVise, Professor Ben Brewer, and to Gabe for joining me. Next week, we have an in-depth conversation with Mr. Walkable City himself, Jeff Speck. He's another expansive thinker with some remarkable ideas. By the way, if you have a moment, take a look at the Outspoken Cyclist blog and let me know if you like the new format. It's still getting a few tweaks, but you'll get the idea. It's at OutspokenCyclist.com. And if you like the show, please rate it on your favorite podcast app. Leave a review if you feel like talking about it, too. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.